Welcome to the Quill Fiction Story Guild podcast, a podcast exclusively for members of the Quill Fiction Story Guild. I'm Frances O'Rourke Dowell, and we're reading my work in progress friendship album, 1934. Thank you for joining us, and as always, thank you for being part of the Quill Fiction community. Now, on to the story. Chapter 17. As the Greyhound bus sped toward Columbus, acres of green fields and farms unfolding outside her window, Bess felt a strange sensation blooming inside of her. She couldn't put a name to what it was, only that she hadn't felt it in years, maybe not since she was a little girl. Finally, it came to her. For the first time in several decades, Bess was unattached, free. Now, in some ways, Bess was more attached than she'd ever been. She was attached to her girls and to Edwina, and now she was officially attached to Joe Mayfield, legally wed, the paper signed and witnessed. Only she and Joe knew, and they hadn't decided yet when to tell the others. Their children, their friends, the congregation at St. Luke's. It was a bit like being married in the ether, Bess thought, but not actually on Earth. She'd enjoyed the feeling at first. How lovely to have such a marvelous secret. But after several weeks of being a newlywed, Bess felt the need to be back on the ground, which would only happen when she and Joe shared their news. Joe felt it would be best to wait a few more weeks until Teresa was fully recovered and back to her old self. Not that Teresa's old self would be any more excited to hear that Joe and Bess had married than her current self, but at least she would be steady enough to receive the news. The plan was to tell Edwina first and allow her to think about what living arrangements would best suit her. How would she feel if Joe moved into their household? Would it be too strange, the three adults in one house, two of them newlyweds? Or would Edwina find that to her liking? After all, she was a woman who loved conversation, and Joe Mayfield was a man who could converse with the best of them. Besides, until recently, it hadn't been unusual to have several generations living together under one roof. Bess had grown up with her paternal grandmother occupying the bedroom next to hers, and there'd been nothing odd about it in the least. In fact, Bess had always found it wonderful to have her grandmother's warm, gentle presence in the house. Her father had been cool and rather clinical, and though her mother had been maternal in her way, she was always out and about, at this meeting or that tea, and by the time she arrived home, her emotional stores had been depleted. Bess glanced at the small basket on the seat next to her. She'd filled it this morning with treats for Annie, her favorite ginger snap cookies, some lovely stationery, chocolates wrapped in cellophane, and had put a sandwich for herself on top in case she got hungry during the two-hour trip to Columbus. It was only 9:30, and Bess wasn't the least bit hungry, but those chocolates with their caramel-filled centers were a temptation. Perhaps just one to make the trip go by a little faster? Ah, yes, candy was just the thing, Bess thought after taking the tiniest nibble. She'd eat it slowly, make it last. When was the last time someone had brought chocolate to the house, she wondered, if ever? Before the market crashed, it hadn't been unusual for Bill to bring home flowers, but he lacked a sweet tooth and it had never occurred to him to buy Bess chocolates. So it had been a nice surprise when Edwina's new beau had stopped by the house Sunday afternoon with a small bag of candy in hand.
"I just happened to be walking past the confectioner's yesterday. You know it, yes? French's Sweet Shop?"
Bonaparte Fellows said as he offered the bag to Edwina.
I looked at all of the delights in the window and immediately thought of the delightful times I've shared with you since we first met.
Edwina's bow. Oh, she'd laugh if Bess said it out loud. But it did seem like Edwina and Mr. Fellows had been spending a good deal of time together since their first outing a few weeks ago, when they went to see a matinee performance of Hamlet at the Southern Theater in Columbus. As things turned out, the older gentleman loved Shakespeare as much as Edwina did. In fact, she reported that the two of them had spent the train ride home reciting their favorite sonnets to each other. Perhaps this new friendship would lead to more, and it would be Edwina petitioning for a way out of the living arrangements that she and Bess had made last fall. Their agreement to share a house rested on a handshake. They weren't legally bound to one another. Still, Bess believed that she had an obligation to Edwina, and her marriage to Joe wouldn't change that. As for Jane and Helen, well, Jane would be leaving for college in a matter of months and had already hinted that if Bess and Father Joe ever married, she was happy for the good Reverend to take up residence in the family abode. Helen would be Helen, which was to say, her response would be dramatic, though it would depend on her mood and how close she was to her time of the month, not to mention the barometric air pressure as to what form the drama would take. She might burst into joyful clapping as she spun around the room. Or, conversely, she might stomp heavily up the stairs and slam her bedroom door to signify her displeasure. Bess hoped for and even anticipated the joyful dance, but she knew not to count on it. Regardless, Helen was a child, and she would have to accept whatever arrangements that Bess decided upon. Bess reached into the cellophane bag that held the chocolates. There had been a dozen of them. What difference would it make to Annie if the bag only held 10? She wouldn't be any the wiser, after all. Besides, Bess had so much to think about. It might take at least 3 chocolate caramels to get her through the trip. She hadn't seen Annie since Christmas, when she, George, and baby Will came home for a visit. Bess wrote to her eldest daughter every Sunday and typically received Annie's reply by the end of the week. She always felt like she was up on the latest news, Will's first peal of laughter, his first steps. But it wasn't the same as being in the same room with Annie as they played with the baby, the conversation flowing along from topic to topic, from how to cure colic to how to get stains out of the carpet, to what to make for dinner that night, to an article in the most recent issue of Good Housekeeping. Annie had been so awfully young when she and George married, only 19 on her wedding day. And Bess hadn't been ready to let her go. She'd always been Bess's helper, the daughter she'd leaned on. Annie helped Bess with the younger girls and assisted with planning birthday parties and family outings. She drew up menus for picnics, happily rounded up supplies for an afternoon by the lake, and built snow forts with her sisters when winter storms closed the schools. Bess never had to ask Annie to do these things, and sometimes she took her oldest daughter's help for granted. In fact, on more than one occasion, Dorothy had prodded Bess to take Annie out for a special treat, saying, "That girl works as hard around here as I do." Not true, of course, but Bess was glad for these reminders to let Annie know her efforts were very much appreciated. Bess had looked forward to the day when she and Annie would be able to spend time together as grown women. She'd imagined the two of them at home in the morning discussing their plans, Jane and Helen getting ready for school, Bill at the counter pouring his cup of coffee and teasing them about one thing or another, how he was sure their day would be consumed by shopping trips and teas. Bess had thought it might be several years after graduation before Annie left to start her own home. She and George had gone steady since their junior year in high school, but George would be going off to college after he graduated. Bess assumed that Annie would live at home until George had graduated from nearby Ashland College. Then the young couple would get married and buy a darling little house close to the Wilcoxes' home on Arthur Street. So many things had changed so quickly. Bess had a hard time mapping them out in her mind. 5 months before high school graduation, George's father died after a long illness, and his mother had decided to move to Columbus, where she had grown up and still had family. In turn, George registered for classes at The Ohio State University to be closer to his mother, and then he proposed to Annie. 6 months later, they were married at St. Luke's, and 2 months after that, Bill had died. Then, as if to prove that life very much went on, 5 months after Bill died, Annie was pregnant. Bess's head still spun, thinking about that tumultuous year. In fact, it might take another chocolate caramel to settle herself down again. Besides, hadn't Annie confessed in her last letter that those last pregnancy pounds were doing their best to stay on her hips? She might not appreciate the temptation of too many chocolates. Yes, Bess would be doing her daughter a favor by eating just one more. She'd always been thankful that Bill had lived long enough to see Annie and George married. He'd been fond of George from the very start. Well, who wouldn't be fond of George? Bess thought as a bite of creamy chocolate softened in her mouth. He was a gentle giant, a good-natured young man who shared Annie's love of books and music and Bill's fondness for fishing at a nearby lake. Bess wondered if Bill had had his own dreams about the young couple moving back to Milton Falls after George graduated. He'd never said so, but perhaps Bill had thought of George as a son he'd never had. Bess felt a sudden pang of sadness. How Bill would have loved his little namesake. How Will would have loved his grandfather. But he would love Joe too, Bess reminded herself, and that thought cheered her. She doubted that Will would care when he discovered that Joe was really his step-grandfather. What did it matter after all? By the time Will was old enough to understand such things, Joe would be a part of his life, the only grandfather he'd ever known. Looking out the window, she could see the edges of the city. Had it only been a year ago when she and the others had driven their Century of Progress quilts to the Sears and Roebuck in the heart of downtown Columbus? What an adventure that had been! By the time Bess had finished her quilt, she'd lost faith that it would win any prizes. It was a darling quilt, well constructed and all that, but seeing it in the same room with Eula, Dorothy, and Emmeline's quilts, Bess had known her chances of winning as much as an honorable mention were close to nil. But what fun to walk around the large downtown that day and imagine what it would be like to live in a big city. A big city compared to Milton Falls, at least. To find oneself in a river of people with important places to go, horns honking, city buses wheezing by. It had been a beautiful day in May, one of the first days where thoughts of Bill's were frequent, but not wounding, not tinged with grief. It had been a gift, she'd thought, to think of Bill and to feel nothing but pleasure, knowing how he would have enjoyed popping into a particular sporting goods shop or seeing the William McKinley Memorial outside the State House on Capitol Square. Annie and George's bungalow on Tompkins Street, a few blocks away from the university, wouldn't seem out of place in one of Milton Falls' quiet neighborhoods, Bess thought as the house came into view. It was a pretty little place with a postage stamp front yard and a white picket fence. Annie and Will were outside, digging in the dirt near the porch when Bess reached the front gate.
"What have you decided to plant in the garden?" she called. "Black-eyed Susans again?"
"Mother," Annie called back, standing and pulling Will up on her hip. "You're early." "Our driver was quite speedy," Bess reported. "He seemed very proud of the fact that the bus pulled into the station 15 minutes ahead of time."
"I'd intended to have lunch on the table by the time you arrived. Will, are you going to say hello to Mimsy?"
Will buried his face in his mother's shoulder, and Annie shook her head.
"He's been acting shy all week. Mother Kerrigan stopped by a few days ago, and he stayed like this the whole time. I think she blamed me."
"Maybe he's not sure that Mimsy is the right name for me," Bess offered. "Perhaps he'd prefer Grammy."
"But Mimsy is just so darling."
Annie nodded toward the porch. "Let's go eat. I'm famished, aren't you?" Bess was too full of chocolate to be famished, but she nodded all the same. "I'm so looking forward to seeing what you've made. Did you try that chicken salad recipe I clipped from the Ladies' Home Journal?"
"I have tried it, and it's delicious," Annie said as she led Bess inside.
"But yesterday, I was in the cellar and found the last of our apples. And as luck would have it, the paper carried a recipe for apple soup just last week. So I thought I'd give that a try."
"Apple soup?" Bess kept her tone even. Annie was a wonderful cook, most of the time. But her new experiments could be risky. She hadn't yet learned how to read a recipe and recognize whether or not it was one worth making.
"Yes, apple soup. And it's lovely. Admittedly, it would work better as a fall dish. But I've made baked potatoes with cheese and baked bread this morning, so even if you don't love the soup, you won't go home hungry. Though I do wish you'd stay the night, Mother. 4 hours on a bus all in one day is so taxing."
By now, they were in Annie's sweet little kitchen, pretty white curtains catching the early May breeze. Bess couldn't help but think of Elise's kitchen, now crowded with baby bottles and rubber nipples and diapers soaking in a bucket of bleach in the corner.
"Did I tell you that my friend Eula is a grandmother?" Bess asked Annie as she put down her handbag and then reached for Will, who had started to take little peeks at her. It was a hard birth. Elise, Eula's daughter-in-law, almost died. In fact, there was a moment. Bess paused, remembering how close they'd come to losing Elise, how the girl still seemed to be in shock.
"Well, suffice to say, if it hadn't been for Eula's competent midwifery and the doctor's arrival in the nick of time, neither mother nor child would have survived. And Elise..." Again, Bess paused. Annie walked over to Bess and handed her little Will, who struggled a bit in the exchange but finally allowed it.
"What, Mother? Is Elise all right?"
"She is, at least physically. But she won't get out of bed." Bess buried her nose into Will's hair and breathed in deeply. "Eula is so worried. We all are. If you knew Elise, well, she's just the most lively, cheerful person. So to see her in bed, barely acknowledging the baby, a girl, by the way, they've named her Jean after Eula. I mean, Jean is Eula's middle name."
Annie pulled a soup tureen out of the icebox and carried it to the counter. "I know a girl that happened to. It lasted for months, and then one day she was herself again. But it was so sad. It was as though she'd missed the first year of her baby's life."
"I hope Elise gets better sooner than that," Bess said. "There's so much going on right now. They've started construction on a house, and they've got a farm. Eula is practically living over there right now. We're all doing what we can to help."
"You and your quilting ladies?" Annie asked as she filled two bowls with soup.
"Yes," Bess said, "although they've become more than that."
Of course they have. If you spend every week in a circle talking and sewing, you end up stitching your lives together along with the quilts. Annie smiled at her mother and then said, Come, I've already got the table set. You bring Will out and put him in his high chair, and I'll bring out the lunch. Tell me about the soup, Bess said as she guided Will into the wooden chair and then attached the tray. Will it be like eating apple pie? Annie came in carrying the bowls. Oh, no, though it's made with apple cider, but lemon juice keeps it tart instead of overly sweet. It's thickened with cornstarch. Now, let me get the potatoes. The bread's in that basket. Give Will a piece to chew on, will you? How many teeth does he have now? Bess asked, breaking a piece of bread in two and giving one of the halves to her grandson. Oh, just those four that you see, Annie said from the kitchen. A moment later, she returned with the potatoes. I kept these warm in the oven. They've got butter and cheese. I take it you're trying to fatten me up, Bess laughed, and then thought of the bag of chocolates, of which she'd eaten five. Not that I'm not capable of doing that all by myself. You look wonderful, Mother, Annie exclaimed. Pretty as a picture and awfully young for your age. Why, I can't imagine why Father Mayfield hasn't proposed to you yet. Bess felt her cheeks grow warm. Oh, you know, he's awfully busy. Mother, Annie interrupted her. He has proposed, hasn't he? Why, it's written all over your face. You're blushing like a schoolgirl. Bess didn't know what to say. She didn't want to lie to Annie. It would be a breach of trust. But how could she tell one of her daughters and not tell the other two? That felt like a betrayal of Jane and Helen. Looking across the table at her eldest child, Bess remembered those long-ago dreams that one day she and Annie would sit together in the mornings and plan their days. Two grown women with chores and shopping to do, letters to write, and friends to visit. In one way or another, Annie had always been set apart from her younger sisters. Bess's helper, her second in command, even on occasion her confidant. She'd always known things that Jane and Helen hadn't been privy to. Why not this? And besides, Bess was dying to tell someone. What would you say if I told you that not only has Joe proposed? Bess could feel her cheeks redden again, but this time she was smiling. But we've gone and gotten ourselves married. Annie jumped out of her chair and rounded the table so fast that Will cried out in surprise. Mother, you haven't, she cried, leaning down to hug Bess. How marvelous! But why keep it a secret? Bess explained about Teresa needing more time. She talked about Edwina and how the older woman might feel as though she should move out if Joe moved in. The entire time she spoke, Annie was nodding her head. It is a pickle, she said after Bess was finished. I imagine I'd have done the same thing if I were you. But I don't think you should wait too long to tell. Right now it's a secret, but it won't be too long until it feels as though it's a deception. Bess stared at her daughter. That's exactly what your father would say. Only it's strange to imagine Dad advising you in this particular situation, Annie said with a laugh that quickly staccatoed into a sob. Oh, I'm sorry, Mother. I've just been thinking about Dad so much lately. Will looks like him, don't you think? Only Mother Kerrigan thinks he looks like George's brother Martin. That's all she talks about. I think Will looks like you, Bess said, and then she took a sip of soup. Oh, Annie, this is delicious. You sound like you had your doubts, Annie said, laughing and wiping her eyes at the same time. I admit that I did, Bess said, and I'll also admit I've been thinking about your father, how I wish he could have known Will, and Will him. Annie nodded. That's what I've been thinking, too. That and how sad I am that Will doesn't have any grandfathers.
She stopped and then laughed again. But now he does. Oh, Mother, how wonderful. Father Joe will be Will's grandfather.
What should Will call him?
What rhymes with Mimsy? Bess asked as she handed Will another piece of bread, the first one having been chewed and then deposited in a white mushy hill on his tray.
I think Grandpa would be nice, don't you? Annie said, ignoring her mother. Grandpa Joe. Oh, I like that.
Bess dabbed her eyes with her napkin. I like it too. I don't know why I'm crying.
I don't know, but now you've got me started, Annie complained.
And with that, the two women turned to their soup, laughing and crying and telling Will stories about his Grandpa Joe, who would come to visit him soon, and his grandfather Bill, who had gone away but loved him very much all the same.
Thanks for joining us on the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast. We're reading Friendship Album 1934, a novel by Frances O'Rourke Dow, a production of Milton Falls Media, Incorporated. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved. Until next time, this is Frances O'Rourke Dow. Thank you for joining us.